Well, please take out a Bible and turn to Mark 14. Our text is 43 to 52. Early this spring, I got one of those phone calls that is a parent's worst nightmare. One of the leading families at our high school had just lost their 21-year-old son in a traffic accident. And he was down on the 210 in Pasadena and swerved to miss a dog on the freeway. Hit the center divide and a truck hit his door. And I was especially close to this family because their three kids were the exact same age as ours. We went through the schools together and participated in all athletic events. And their daughter was especially dear to me because I coached her in high school. And now here I was to officiate at their son's funeral. And what do you say when the unthinkable happens? And as a parent, you always pray for the safety of your kids. You know, you commend your children to God's right hand, His strength to seize them. And now you feel abandoned, left alone to pick up the ashes. And I find at times like that, you can't say anything. But I'm just thankful that our Lord experienced it. And the book of Mark at this place in the text speaks to that kind of parental pain. And if you understand the Old Testament, it's a very interesting thing. Before the Messiah came, Isaiah the prophet predicted of God's Messiah. He said in Isaiah 42, "I am the Lord, I've called you in righteousness, and I will also hold you in my hand and watch over you." And then in Isaiah 41, he says the same thing. "I am the Lord your God who upholds your right hand and who says, do not fear, for I will help you." And as you go on and read what that help means in Isaiah, it says because God seizes him in his right hand, he's going to make the Messiah like a sharp, double-edged threshing sledge that would thresh and pulverize the mountains and make the hills chaff. So that's the promise. "I'll lay hold of you, and your enemies will be dust." Now, when you come to this text in Mark, Mark picks up that same word to seize or to lay hold of, and he uses it four times as sort of the theme of this text. But in this case, rather than God laying hold of the Son of Man, it's the enemies who seem to have all the power to seize him. And God is painfully absent, allowing all the evil forces to play every card in their hand. This is a worst-case scenario text. And what Mark wants us to focus on is, as the Son of Man is center stage and that is happening to him, what's the human reaction of the disciples around Jesus when evil appears to have the upper hand? And a very surprising ending, Mark paints a tiny portrait of hope to penetrate through the darkness. So that's our text and where we're going. So if we look at it in verse 43 and following. "And immediately while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. And he who was betraying him had given them a signal, saying, 'Whoever I shall kiss, he is the one. Seize him and lead him away under guard.' And after coming, he immediately went to him, saying, 'Rabbi,' and he kissed him. And they laid their hands on him and seized him. But a certain one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus answered and said to them, 'If you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as against an insurrectionist, every day I was with you in the temple teaching and you did not seize me. But this happened that the scriptures might be fulfilled.' And they all left him and fled." So if you remember the scene from last week when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he had set up his three disciples to watch and pray while he prayed that the cup might pass from him. And every time he went away to pray, they went away to sleep. And now he's just finished his rebuke that they are sleeping instead of watching. And just as he finishes that rebuke, a figure emerges out of the darkness. Guess who? One of his own sons, Judas. And behind him is a large mob of a well-trained detachment of Roman soldiers, along with the temple police that was sent by the Sanhedrin. And Mark tells us they're a little overdressed for the occasion. They're armed to the teeth with their flak jackets and Uzis and riot gear and a tank or two. And the Romans were always cautious during feast times that there'd be no violence, and they wanted to keep the peace. And in light of Jesus' popularity, I imagine they expected to meet with some stiff resistance when they arrested him. Therefore, they really had to plan this mission carefully. The first thing they had to do was to pick a time and a place where Jesus would be off the public stage, and so they could arrest him secretly. There'd be no threat of public violence. Then they had to give a prearranged signal to know who it was, and it was dark, and so they had to have a very well thought out signal to identify Jesus out of the crowd. And so the signal Judas chose was a kiss. And that forever transformed the kiss into a symbol of betrayal. Now, once Jesus was identified, the troops were to move in quickly, and they were to secure their prisoner and lead him away with no chance of escape. And you can see that Judas, once he'd become involved in this wicked affair, did not want to make a fiasco out of it. So, you know, he wanted the SWAT team to come in and get the victim and get out of there as soon as possible. Now, Judas probably escorted the mob first to the upper room, knowing that that's where the disciples were, and seeing that it was vacated, then probably picked the next logical place he thought the disciples would be. So he went from the upper room and down the Kidron Valley and into the Garden of Gethsemane. When he enters the garden, it's very easy to slip past the guards. They're asleep. And seeing Jesus, Judas throws his arms open wide with great affection and says, "Rabbi!" And then he kisses him. Imagine the horror Jesus goes through as he submits to that kiss. And it wasn't a light touch on the cheek. Mark intensifies the verb, meaning it was a long, protracted kiss. That is disgusting. And the ancient proverb stings us. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but excessive are the kisses of an enemy. So the signal was now given, and the horde of soldiers descend upon their defenseless victim. They seize him and arrest him. And in the ensuing chaos, an unnamed disciple, whose initials are Peter, grabs a sword. And in an attempt to defend his master, he wounds the slave of the high priest by cutting off his ear. Which may have a touch of irony that Jesus is about to meet a high priest who's deaf, who won't listen to Jesus. And John tells us it was Peter, and that the ear belonged to a servant of the high priest named Malchus. And apparently Peter aimed at his head, but Malchus sidestepped, and all he could get was his ear. So here is Peter, who did not prepare himself in prayer. Now he's suddenly seized with the impulse to live up to his bold promise that even if you do die, I'll die with you. But sadly, it is misguided zeal, and his boldness is very short-lived. And such action only confirms Jesus' words to him. You remember what Jesus said? The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. So if you haven't prayed and you haven't cast yourself on God's dependence, any impulse you have is flesh and worthless. So now we come to the turning point of the scene with Jesus' speech. Here is one who's prayed and been strengthened by God, and he stands there and he gets face to face with his betrayer. And rather than fighting or fleeing, he accepts the kiss. Incredible. And then he speaks, and his words have penetrating power, rarely found on the human tongue. He says, "Have you come out to me with swords and clubs to arrest me as against a robber?" I said, insurrectionist is a better translation. Laestes means a violent revolutionary. That's what Barabbas was. Someone who's going to lead a revolution by force. That's the term labeled Jesus. So he says, you've come out to me as a laestes, an insurrectionist, when every day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. There's your key word. So before their evil acts, Jesus is trying to make them face who they are by exposing their motives. And he asks them, "Why are you arresting me in this manner, armed to the teeth, like a violent insurrectionist, when I'm just a rabbi? Publicly teaching you day by day." And again, you can hear the Byron biting sarcasm. "Aren't you a little overdressed for the occasion? And then why at this time, secretly in the dark, when I was easily accessible day by day teaching in the temple? Why didn't you seize me then?" And it's obvious the arrest reveals far more about their evil motives than his supposed crimes. It's really about them. And then he says, "But this happened that the scriptures might be fulfilled." Now, that doesn't remove their culpability. It displays his trust. And I think here we can begin to understand the mystery of prayer. What did prayer do for Jesus? God has so strengthened him that he can face his betrayer and expose and condemn their motives on the one hand, while on the other, seeing the sovereign hand of God giving them the freedom to play every card in the deck unhindered. That's what prayer did. And so he says, it was necessary that the scriptures be fulfilled. As Isaiah says of the God servant, he was numbered for among the transgressors. That's why I'm arrested like a transgressor. Isaiah said so. And I think that's a great gift. When you can get to the place through prayer that you can walk into evil and be able to expose and condemn the wickedness of the human free will while at the same time recognizing the divine hand behind it, you've arrived to a very special, honorable place spiritually. That's why we need to pray. Now, the minute Jesus says the words fulfilled, what happens? All his disciples flee, every last one, including the guy that took the sword and fought. As one commentator says, the words drive home, as it were, with hammer blow, the failure of the disciples without exception and the complete forsakenness of Jesus. And so here are Zechariah's words fulfilled. "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd and against the man, my associate, declares the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd and the sheep may be scattered." So that's how the little scene ends. And you're sort of left in the throes of the divine mystery that here's the Son of Man, who Daniel wrote would belong all power and authority and dominion forever and ever. That Son of Man is now seized by his enemies and abandoned by his friends. The long-awaited Son of Man, who would be victorious over all world powers, has now fallen victim to them. And so as we sort of gasp in horror that that's happening, and we grope for understanding to make meaning of that, Mark adds more to the mystery with an anonymous bystander taking center stage. Verse 51. "And a certain young man was following him, wearing a linen sheet over his naked body, and they seized him." But he left his linen sheet behind and escaped naked. What in the world is that doing in there? You get a laundry list of an anonymous young man. So here he is, unnamed. You don't know who he is. And in contrast to the disciples who are fleeing, he is described as following Jesus. And in contrast to the overdressed mob, he's decidedly underdressed, clothed only with the linen garment over his naked body. We found it. It's up here. And you hear that twice in the text for a little poetic emphasis. Twice you hear the word linen. Twice you hear the word naked. Now, the garment suggests this young man was wealthy. Since the garment described is not the normal underwear or undergarment, but it's an outer tunic or a sheet, which was normally made of wool. This one is made of linen, which is extremely expensive material worn only by the rich. So if you ask, who is this mysterious onlooker? Scholars have spent a lot of oil and ink trying to figure it out, and most people suggest that it is the young John Mark himself, the author to our gospel. He, in fact, did come from a wealthy home. It's very likely the upper room took place in his house, and as a teenager, he probably heard those events down the hallway. And we could well imagine him on Passover night, unable to sleep in the warm air, and he's sleeping on the roof. And he tosses and turns on his bed, sensing a strange foreboding in the air. So this inquisitive teenager leaps out of bed and grabs the only thing available, the linen sheet, and scampers down the drain pipe and wanders through the streets of Jerusalem, half naked, down the Kidron Valley, and he comes up the Garden of Gethsemane, and there it's all happening. And suddenly, as Jesus is arrested, the soldiers spot him hiding in the trees, and they lay their hands on him and seize him. But he manages to wiggle out of his linen garment, and he escapes all the way back to Jerusalem naked. And so scholars have thought this was Mark's way to put his signature on his work. As Theodore Zahn says, Mark paints a small picture of himself in the corner of his work. Now, I think the scholars are right. I think that is John Mark. But I do think the function of the anonymous man may also serve other purposes here in the text. And I think Gundry rightly points out that the double emphasis of the linen cloth anticipates the linen cloth Jesus will wear when he is buried. And the young man's nakedness, except for linen cloth, may anticipate the soldiers dividing Jesus' garments among themselves. And leaving the linen cloth behind anticipates and foreshadows Jesus' resurrection, where the linen cloth will be in the tomb. And when Mark paints the resurrection, outside the tomb is an angel who Mark describes as a young man, unnamed. And he's not wearing a linen cloth, but a white robe, symbolic of resurrection life. And though neither young man is Jesus, together they represent him in his death, burial, and resurrection. And just as the young man flees the scene of Jesus' arrest, so the women, when they discover the emptiness of Jesus' tomb and see the linen garment, they flee to tell of the resurrection. So what is the purpose of this incident? I think it's Mark's way of saying that though the worst case scenario happens, and evil plays every card in its deck, the Son of Man is seized, that is not the last word. Evil may be given ultimate freedom. They may execute their plans. The terrible may happen, but there'll be a grand reversal of this arrest in a glorious resurrection. That's what Mark's telling us. Now, the question I want to ask you all, as you look at this whole scenario, is where are we in this dark night of arrest and betrayal? And I think if we stand back to get a picture of the whole story, here is Jesus center stage. And you find that every player in the story, they're all disciples, and they're all reacting to Jesus' betrayal and arrest, which is the first display of his humiliation of the cross. And so this gripping account tells us the very natural human reaction disciples will have throughout the age when confronted with Jesus' humiliation. How do we respond as disciples when we see the Christ overpowered and evil consuming him? And our response is very, very significant, because if we don't get it right here, we won't get it right when it's our turn to act our dramas, when we have to drink a taste of that cup. So Mark gives us four different responses. As I said, they're all by disciples: Judas, Peter, the 12, and the unknown young man. So the first is Judas. Now, I have no idea when Judas first placed it in his heart to betray Jesus. I imagine it was sometime when Jesus repeatedly made known his kingdom agenda. You remember those texts in Mark? And he announced that under no circumstances was he going to engage in a violent revolution by force. He came to die. And when Peter shouted back at Jesus, "Surely you shall not die," I'm sure that echoed Judas's sentiments. I mean, to die in that kind of deal was at worst shameful, if not repulsive, to Judas. And the only difference, I think, between Peter and Judas is that Peter was teachable. And so when Jesus shot back at Peter with that shameful rebuke, "Get behind me, Satan," I'm sure Judas's blood boiled. And I imagine the sort of last nail in the coffin of him not submitting and the point of no return is when Jesus got on that humble donkey and made his entrance into Jerusalem that way. I'm sure at that point, Judas felt betrayed. He'd followed this one. He'd given everything to follow him. And he was not going to do his agenda the way he wanted. So at that point, swallowed in his own disillusionment, he says, "I'm going to go another path. Jesus may be humiliated, and I will appear loyal and I'll lavish him with affection, but underneath that guise of affection, I'll use Jesus for my own personal gain. Betray him with a kiss and in the process make a buck." That was the Judas way. Now that betrayal, when Judas kissed Jesus, had such an impact on the 12 and shot through them with such horror that in the early Christian teaching, a little book called the Didache, which is a first century kind of Christian manual of worship, the apostles made sure that no teacher ever made that mistake again and used the humiliation of Jesus for their own gain. So it says in that book, when traveling teachers are to go hither and yon, it says, "And let the apostle, when he's gone forth to city, take nothing for his journey except bread, and only enough to last him until he reaches his lodgings for the night. But if he asks for money, he's a false prophet." How many Christians would that put out of business today? If he asks for money, he's a false prophet. And that way they wanted to keep the church pure of disciples who were going to use the humiliation of Jesus for personal gain. And sadly, our generation has not heeded the warning. And if you ask, what is the world's perception of the church? I think many would say it's the Judas view. It's Christian leaders using the humiliation of Christ for their own gain. So that's the first response. The second response is represented by Peter. Peter was the one who was sleeping. And instead of being vigilant and praying, he's asleep. Now he is ill-prepared for the crisis. And when the crisis happens, faced with the prospect of the arrest of Jesus, he is seized with the uncontrollable urge to fight back. And his unbridled impulse grips him, and he sort of lunges into action. And he crosses that sacred boundary and he reaches for that illicit weapon of the world, the sword. And you know what's sad? He's not even any good at using it. He can't even hit his mark, and he leaves a bloody mess. And I think that's what happens when the church tries to fight the world the world's way. We're not even good at it. You want to fight Goliath in Goliath's armor, he'll kill you. And I think a sad commentary, too, is that after the blood is spilt, there's no winners, is there? There's no redemption taking place when we operate that way. And it's very difficult to erase the memory for the victims, those slaves whose ears we've lopped off. I think today, for example, ask a Jew what the cross means to them. What does the symbol of the cross mean to the Jews today? And I don't think many will tell you, oh, the suffering servant who came and died. They won't say that. You know what they'll say? Auschwitz, Holocaust, Russian pogroms. And I know in working with Jews, it is so difficult to penetrate past that memory. You have to tiptoe in your symbolism as you talk to them to get into them because of this horror of all their ears being lopped off and their heads lopped off by Christians who impose the cross of violence. So put away the sword. So betrayal and fight. The third response is, if you can't beat them, run away. Flight. And notice, when does flight happen? It happens when Jesus takes total control of the situation, exposes the evil motives, and then it seems that the die is cast and the cross looms imminent, and then what happens? Fear takes over. Fear. It's obvious you can't overcome evil, so you just run away. Flee to the desert, go to the mountains. Remove yourselves from the crossroads of this world. Flee the schools. Flee the civic centers. Flee the halls of justice. Flee the courts. Flee the government. And then you surround yourselves with other disillusioned followers. And what do? You just complain. And that's how some people think retirement is. You know, you just get out of here, surround yourself with all the disillusioned people, and just complain until you die. But you're already dead. Now, Mark says that's not an option. You can run from this garden, but you cannot escape the pain. So now we come to the fourth response. Now, I think the fact that all three of those responses were played out by disciples suggests that is going to be the common reaction to the humiliation of Jesus in every generation. We'll all succumb to it. Be natural. The fourth response is where God in his grace is leading us as true disciples. And you'll notice that this man is unnamed. Here is his cameo appearance in the gospel. He approaches the scene as a hidden observer. He doesn't know what he's going to find. He comes with no weapons and very little clothing. Yet he's so captivated by what he sees. He continues to follow Jesus even when everybody else has left. So here is one who does not fight or flee, but remains right at the center. And then suddenly, he finds himself pulled into the center of the drama, seized with the same fate as Jesus. Here he is outmanned, outgunned, death looks inevitable, but then suddenly, though he endures the humiliation of his own nakedness, he amazingly is given back his life. And he escapes unscathed, leaving all his wealth behind. Now, is Mark telling us that that is a foretaste of the resurrection life? I think he is. But then you ask the question, why put this scene here when if I just keep reading in Mark and I keep turning the pages, I'm going to come to the resurrection? Why do you need the foretaste? And I think what God is telling us is the long-range view of the resurrection is so important that God takes great care to leave behind fragrant hints of it, signs of it, even while we are trampled by our worst fears. That's what he says. When I went into my friend's home, I've learned as a pastor over the years, when you go into a situation when a tragedy's happened, and you're walking on holy ground, you don't say anything. You just go in with your eyes and your ears open to see God at work. And you try and seize that and capture that. So when I walked in and hugged a very numb mother and dad, the mom took me to the bedroom of her son. And she says, "You see the poster up there?" I says, "Yeah." And here was a poster that the son had just put up in his room. And it was a beautiful sunset over the desert, and the colors were magnificent. And the sign underneath the sunset read these words, "When you see a sign from heaven." And the family took that and made that the cover of their memorial service cover. And so when I got to the service, I just said, "As a dad, let me just tell you why I believe in heaven." Now, the sad thing about this text is God did this beautiful sign to encourage the disciples, but they'd run away, and they didn't see it. And I have to admit, there's been times in my life I have fled, and I have run, because I was fearful, and I couldn't look death in the eye, so I ran. And I shared this story with many of you, but it fits, so forgive me. But the monumental time in my life when this happened was the death of our second child. And when I got the news report that my daughter was sick, I knew the end, because I'd been through it with my son, and now we're a year later going through your daughter, and you know the end from the beginning, so the emotions are double. And I made one trip to Stanford Hospital to get one last look, and I didn't want to go. And there she was laying there. And it was too much. One look was all I could do. And I turned and walked away, and I was with one of our elders, and this grief just came over me. Just heavens were saying, "Pour out your grief like water." And I couldn't do it because I felt embarrassed. So I walked away from that scene, from that garden, and my daughter died alone, abandoned by her dad. Well, then as a pastor, you know, I serve you guys, and I watch you guys go through the same thing. I have to go to Alta Mesa Cemetery at times and stand on graves with your kids' names on them and watch you guys go through your grief. And I'm at that scene, and because the hospital took care of my kid and buried him, we didn't have a memorial service. And I'm standing there in these marked stones. I go, "Where's my daughter?" And then it happened. 16 years after I lost my daughter, I get a call by one of the families here at the church. And I got to make a run to the hospital, the same hospital my daughter died. And it's the same month, and it's raining like it was. I'm going to the same ward, and all the memories are coming flooding back. And I'm watching this couple love their son, a six-year-old little boy. And I left. I ran. And on the way home, God said to me, "Go back. You can't run anymore." So I turned the car around and went back to Stanford and walked up there, and we gathered around the bed, and we started singing. The end of the bed is the unnamed person dressed in white, the nurse. And I didn't know she was a Christian. And we're singing the hymn "It Is Well With My Soul." And I didn't know the second verse, but she boomed out the second verse. And when she boomed it out, heaven came into the room. And our nakedness of fear was clothed with these garments of white, of peace. And just, we were flooded with peace. And everybody felt it. It was a transcendence that was greater than death, and we're right there at death's door. And I was so thankful that God let me go back to see what I missed, just like he did the disciples. Mark recorded this event so they could see it. They missed it, but here it is. And so after that event, I wrote these words about that night. I wrote, "O holy night, angels sang, the grip of night grew limp. He appeared, and each soul felt its worth. He did not turn away traumatized by pain, but stretched out his hand and placed it into the flame. Beyond his hand I saw the wrist, impaled by my spear, pierced so deep with wounds, yet draws me near. Beyond his wrist the gaze, Oh, that gaze, ablaze with such love, it burst my breast, evoking deepest praise. Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, grave, where is your sting? Captured with awe, I stared and stared. And then I knew that when I left, oh, Jessica, he had cared for you. Amen.